Accession number 10231, reel number 1.
Sir Ronald Swin, reel 1. How did you come to be involved with commando work in the first place, Sir Ronald?
The origin of the commandos was, I think, an idea that was cooked up by Churchill and that very good Little Hart, that great war correspondent and writer. And the idea was to send independent companies, they were to be called, to Norway to expand into guerrilla forces. And these were selected from various divisions, a brigade sending a platoon, making three platoons from the division, and a section from each battalion in the brigade, with some Royal Engineers and RAMC and Signals, and clerks and so on. I can't remember the total numbers. I don't think they were more than about 300, something like that. I was in the 38th Division, which was a territorial Welsh border division, and I was selected from my regiment, the Herefordshire Regiment, to take a section of Herefordshire boys, which I did, selecting lads who came really from round my home, actually, and it was very nice and friendly. And we went off and we were formed into an independent company, which was intended to go to Norway, but by the time we were formed, we were the sort of second wave of this scheme. The war was going very badly, and although we got into a little ship, passenger ship, to go to Norway, we disembarked again and never went. Some went, as you know, and some of the commandos who actually took part in the Saint Nazaire raid were in the Norwegian campaign. You would hear about that from Michael Byrne. But what happened to us was that we were parked in Bellahouston Park in Glasgow at the time of the retreat from Dunkirk. And we suddenly got an instruction that some officers and who could select their men were to report to a certain place in Southampton. They were to find their own way there. They were to billet themselves. They were to be paid 13 fourpence a day to an officer, 6 and 8 a day to a soldier. And they were to take the most extraordinary combination of equipment with them, including a sniper's rifle. This we did, and I and 2 or 3 of my friends went off with a few chaps, all travelling quite independently. And we went through London and went down to Southampton. And that was, I suppose, the real beginning of the commandos. The commanding officer was Colonel Todd, Ronnie Todd of the Argyles. We had 16 troops of 8 men, I think it was. It was a very strange formation. And it was intended to make raids immediately on the French coast. I and my friends put up at the Royal Court Hotel in Southampton very comfortably. And we trained very hard when we were there. And then eventually we were told to go to... these friends of mine were told to go to a hotel in Whitehaven, which we did by train. We were there briefed by Jumbo Lester, who was then a colonel, I think, a marine with a huge moustache, a splendid person, who survived the war, I think was head of the command of the Marines. He was commandant of the Marines at the end of his career. And Jumbo briefed us to go over in crash boats across the channel,
What exactly is a crash boat?
A crash boat's a small motorboat, very small motorboat, which has a little cabin and was built to pick up pilots when they ditched into the drink. It only did about 8 knots, and it didn't have room for more than about, I think there were about 12 of us. And I had 3 men, or 4 men, who, armed to the teeth, were going to go and throw hand grenades and generally beat up a hotel at Merlimont Plage in Le Touquet. And we arrived rather late. It was almost beginning to get light. And we went ashore, and I went off to my objective with my men, and we found it all boarded up, and there was nobody there. And we wandered around a bit looking for Germans, and then gave it up because time was running out, and went back, and we found there was no boat. The boat was hanging around offshore, and we couldn't make contact with it. And some Germans turned up, whom we killed, and that created a bit of a noise, and then some more Germans appeared in the sand dunes, and eventually we persuaded this boat to come in and pick us up again.
How did you kill the first lot of Germans?
I think we bayoneted them. I think I hit one on the head with the butt of my revolver. It wasn't very nice. It wasn't really very serious soldiering. And, of course, because we were being rushed, it was unpardonable, really, but we never got their identity papers, which was very inefficient of us. And we lost a lot of our weapons.
What kind of weapons?
But we had to swim quite a long way out to this boat. I was armed with a 3.8 revolver. I'm sorry to say that I forgot to load it on this occasion. It was why I had to use the butt of my revolver. But my batman bayoneted one, and I grappled with the other, and we killed them.
How far did you have to swim out?
I think it was quite a way, actually. I remember I swam, but I was very exhausted, and I found this boat. I went out to swim to get it. I was wearing breeches, which I suppose made it seem longer. And I demoted the naval officer in charge. I told him he was no longer in charge, and put the coxswain in charge. And we took the boat in closer. We got everybody off. But it was a rather amateurish affair. I'm glad to mention that is because, as I was saying earlier, I read an account by a Cardiff academic whose name I'm afraid I cannot recall. I've been trying to. Eric something or other, who I believe is a very good academic, but he got it completely wrong, and he talked about us throwing hand grenades into a cafe with French girls and German soldiers, which was quite untrue. It was the last thing we would have done. We might have waited outside and beaten up the Germans. So I don't think we would have bombed civilians in a cafe, at least I hope we wouldn't have done. Not at that stage of the war, anyhow.
How do you think he got it so wrong?
I have no idea. I think he must have picked it up verbally from somebody who wasn't there. Colonel Todd, who commanded this outfit, died some years ago. And I think one of the officers who were on my little party was killed in North Africa. One has died. Another one was sacked from the commandos in one of the processes of weeding people out. So I can't. That nobody but myself, I think, is alive who knows that story. He certainly got it all wrong. I mean, it was nothing like that. We landed these. I wasn't the only one. Ronnie Todd landed somewhere else on the coast. I think there were four parties landed, or three parties. They didn't contact Germans, because there weren't very many Germans about in 1914, Touquet.
And the Germans who challenged you were just ordinary Wehrmacht?
Ordinary Wehrmacht, yes. They came out in some force once we'd made a noise and somebody was alerted. And we ran a quite heavy fire when we withdrew, and there was a lot of stuff flying around, but they didn't hit anybody even. We all got away quite safely.
About how long after Dunkirk was this?
Well, it was people were still coming back from Dunkirk. It was certainly in June. I think it was right at the end of June. And then we did another raid on the Channel Islands, which was frightfully badly planned. I mean, it was beautifully planned from an army point of view, but the naval preparation was very inefficient, partly due to inadequate equipment, of course. But they did plan it very well. We had Channel Islanders who were over in England who came from near the airport on Jersey. Is it Jersey or Guernsey? I can't remember. It's super stupid of me. And two parties were to be landed, one on a fairly easy beach on one side of the island as a diversion. They were to land first. And then we were to land at the cliffs and climb up the cliffs, which were quite close to the airport. And we were to bomb the hotel, which was full of German pilots. and blow up the aircraft on the airport. There were quite a lot of planes on the airport. We had Channel Islanders with us who could guide us there from a place on the cliffs where we were to land. We were to go up a path up the cliffs, and there were Nissen huts occupied by with German soldiers in them around the airport, and we were to attack them and blow up the planes. And it was a wonderful idea, and it could have been a very, very clever raid, but the means of transport were absolutely hopeless. They towed gigs and whalers, and I think the crash boats were towed. They may have gone under their own steam, but the gigs and whalers were towed by destroyers. Well, of course, it was much too fast for them, and they got damaged in the going there. And when we got out of from the destroyer into these boats, they were all leaking. And one by one, we were transferred. And eventually, I was in a, I think it was a crash boat, with two or three other officers and some men. And we were right down to the gunwales. And all this had taken so long, and we'd arrived at the rendezvous late, that it was nearly daylight. Fortunately, there was a bit of sea mist, but quite impossible to attack. And in any case, by this time, I think we only had one boat which was capable of carrying people. And we decided it was quite hopeless, and we lost the destroyer, and we decided to put into Sark and anyhow get rid of half the people on board, so that there was a chance of this boat getting back to England under its own steam, under its own power. And we were making for Sark when the destroyer spotted us. Somebody on a destroyer, it was a soldier actually, spotted something in the water. He knew that there were people missing, and he drew the attention of a ship's officer, and he got the ship diverted to pick us up. We got home. It was very lucky we got home.
You've talked about what you describe as the amateurishness of these early operations. Do you think that was just a necessary part of learning?
I think so, yes. And I think it was a brave idea on the part of Churchill or whoever it was, or Roger Keyes, who was in charge of it. But we weren't remotely ready. We didn't know what kind of boats we wanted. We didn't know how to do it. There wasn't a proper planning body to prepare for these raids. And in any case, there was a fearful shortage of weapons and everything, of course. I think we had no Tommy guns then, and we didn't have the Remington Colt, which we were issued with later that year. I think the Remington came in, and the Tommy gun came in August or September with 4-5 ammunition. That was very useful. But we were armed with 3-8 revolvers, which is I always thought a very poor weapon. 4-5 revolver was a good weapon, but the 3-8 had limited penetrating stopping power. Whereas, of course, the Remington was a wonderful, wonderful weapon, very accurate, and had quite a good range, too. And we had Tommy guns later. But there was a shortage of ammunition for teaching the soldiers to shoot, and some of them had hardly done any practice on the range. We were frightfully amateurish. I'd done a lot of shooting because I used to shoot at Bisley, and I used to teach the soldiers as best I could.
Can you make some comments about the kind of soldiers that you recruited?
Yes, the territorial... The independent companies were from the territorial regiments. They were locally based, and so we knew the soldiers pretty well. My soldiers were Herefordshire boys who came from round me in Herefordshire, country lads. And I think they would have been rather good guerrillas eventually, you know, but for commando raids, few of them could swim, so we had to teach them all to swim to begin with. And we did that by just throwing them in off the edge of over the gunwales of a whaler. They soon learned to swim in the Channel Islands, in the Scilly Isles, I mean. But on the whole, the soldiers to begin with were weeded out repeatedly, as The independent companies became the special service battalions. That was in November 1940, I think, round about. And we were A Company. My independent company was put into A Company, number one special service battalion. And then round about the following spring, I think it was, about April 1941, we were moved up to Achnacarry to carry out an expedition to the Azores under General Alexander, which came to nothing in the end, but I think we had some very good training preparing for it, and we were gradually pulling together and becoming much more professional. And at that time, we were turned into number one command there, as opposed to A Company, Special Service Battalion. Now, all these changes meant reduction in numbers of officers and men, and we got rid of the officers and men whom we didn't think were up to scratch, either not fit enough or a bit wet or something other, or we just didn't like them. And they tended to be, the commandos tended to be clubs. When we had a vacancy, people could put up, in my command there, and I think many others, they could put up suggestions to the colonel. And then they'd go on a board, my commander, and you could say you didn't think much of them. It was like a blackball. And each commander had its own character. Some were very much territorial-based. Some were more number three commander, which I think was one of the commanders which was efficient very early on. That was mostly regular officers and regular soldiers, and they were a very good commander. I think my commander was a very good commander, so far as training was concerned. We did a lot of very good training, and they were good material eventually. Number two commander was London-based, territorial, London and Essex. That was the commander which formed the main force for centres there. Very high rate of intelligence and quality, both officers and men. In fact, a lot of the men, if they hadn't have been taken prisoner, would have become officers, and some of those who got home actually became officers later. They were very good. There were other commandos which I don't think were so good. I don't think I ought to mention who they were because I'm not sure I'm qualified to say which, but some never had very much of a future. Number 12 commander was, we used to call the House of Lords. It had a duke and a couple of viscounts and people like that. They were actually disbanded, but they had some very good people. There was nothing wrong with them, but they were just badly led, I think.
Are there any particular individuals whom you worked with whom you'd like to recollect?
So far as doing the same thing with them as you're doing with me, I could recommend one very good one to you, who had great experience, was an innumerable commander. It's called Lee Smith. He lives in Brussels, and I can give you his address. He was a very great friend of mine. He was very intelligent. He was a born staff officer, but he was a jolly good, a very good fighting officer as well. And he was in, I think, about six commandos. And the reason for it was he always knew better. He was nearly always adjutant, and he always knew better than his colonel. And he used to tell him so, and he was nearly always right, which, of course, doesn't endear yourself to anybody. And he was always being smartly moved off to another commander with a high recommendation. He usually got promotion. And he saw a lot of fighting. He was in, I think he was in North Africa. He was certainly in Italy, Salerno. He was at Salerno with the Duke of Wellington when he was killed, who was in 12 commander. He was with Tom Churchill there. And then he was in Italy, he was in France and Belgium, Walcheren, Germany. He saw a lot of fighting. He was very well worth interviewing.
Was there a specific attitude towards discipline which commandos had to have?
Yes, I think it varied from commando to commando. In a commando like number two commando, it was much more like a really well-run public school. I mean, they were put more on their honour. Tough discipline wasn't necessary. In my commando, there was a lot of very tough discipline. I had a very good Herefordshire lad, whom I saw the other day, actually. He went to the glass house for having a fight in a pub, and he got 28 days in the glass house, which was very tough punishment. in North Africa, an NCO, a farmer's son from South Wales, who later got the DCM in Burma and was killed, very gallant fellow, he got field punishment when they were in North Africa. So the discipline was very tough. And I think with our Welshmen and boys from the farms, it was probably not a bad idea. Individually, I can't really say that the discipline in my troop was particularly tough, but it wasn't very difficult to get them to do what you wanted. They got into trouble with the RSM usually, or the pickets, you know, by getting into a brawl. But they weren't badly behaved. I mean, they were just very—they were very good lads who occasionally had a few too many beers on pay night. But they weren't savage thugs at all. Just the opposite.
You've raised this question, which I'd like to go into in some detail, because some people seem to have the image of the commando as a ruthless thug, or even in the case of Hitler, he regarded them as murderers. Can you say something about that kind of image?
Yes, I can, because I think it's totally false. The commandos were drawn. They were, you see, the officers and men and NCOs were fairly hand-picked. The men who were picked tended to be very physically fit. We were most of us very fit physically, played games and that sort of thing, but enjoyed long hauls over the mountains, yomping they call it now, don't they? And we rather enjoyed that sort of thing. We did masses of it. It was nothing to do 20, 30 miles in a day cross country. And we did become immensely fit, but the sort of thug image was something which seemed to, I thought, came after the war. Mind you, I was captured in 42, so I was only in half the war. I think we were rather the opposite of thugs. Certainly the officers were. A lot of the officers were a little bit intellectual, actually. And a number of them wrote books later. And you'll see if you interview something like Captain Byrne, he's anything but a thug. He's just brought out a very successful book on Richard Hillary. And Gerald Brett, who was on the San Jose raid, was later an academic. He was a brilliant scholar on Byzantium, Corpus Oxford. And there were many like that. And I would have thought that the thug image was started by Hitler, I think, after a second raid on the Channel Islands, and I don't know what the incident was, there was a difficulty when you had very few men on unfriendly territory. If you captured a lot of enemy, a problem as to what to do with them. Whether any prisoners were ever killed by the commandos after being taken prisoners, I really don't know, but I would have been very surprised. I know that on one raid, I think it was the Wagser raid, the soldiers were encouraged to shoot before the enemy could put their hands up. In other words, to try and prevent a lot of men being in a position to give themselves up. But I believe it was quite useless, and they took enormous numbers of prisoners and had quite a problem. I'd never heard of anybody behaving like that. I dare say it did happen. I mean, you obviously get some bad apples in any barrel. But I think they would have been regarded... bad apples in any barrel. And I think we would have regarded them as bad apples. It would have been quite foreign to my outlook, certainly. And I think to all the people I served with to behave like thugs.
So what do you do to prisoners to render them harmless?
Well, the few raids I was on, it didn't occur. I suppose there may have been a difficulty at Dieppe on the southern flank, number 4 commander. You could refer to the book by Brigadier Mills Roberts, the right-hand commander. It was number 4 commander, commanded by Lord Lovett, who is still alive, of course. And his second command was Derek Mills Roberts, who was later commanded Number 1 Brigade, who was a great soldier. He took over from Lovett in Normandy after he was badly wounded. I don't think they killed any prisoners. I think they went in pretty hard, you know, to create a shock, and they bayoneted a lot of the gunners on the right flank and shot them up. But I don't think they killed prisoners after the chaps had got their hands up. I never heard of it.
Can we go on now to the Saint-Nazaire raid, and can you tell me, in as much detail as you can, your preparations and what you can recollect of it?
The idea started towards the end, I think, of 1941. Was put up to Lord Louis Mountbatten by Bill Pritchard, who was really the man who had the idea, and Bob Montgomery, who is alive and who was on the raid. Bill Pritchard was killed on the raid. They had come out of Saint-Nazaire in 1940 and seen how much we'd left behind there undamaged. And they felt that we should go back and do something about it. I first heard of it when I was just been married, and my wife and I were with Number 1 Command there in Irvine, and I was selected to take a detachment of 12 from Number 1 Commando to join all to be demolition, a demolition group, to join Number 2 Commando under Colonel Newman, and various detachments who are trained in demolitions from other commandos at various places which were selected, where we did training on blowing up docks. I went to Scotland, to Burnt Island. My sergeant, Tom Durant, who was killed and got the VC, was put in charge as temporary RSM for the party. And I was supposed to be in charge, I think, of the sort of administration up there. I was in a subaltern. Bill Pritchard said I was to take charge of the administration. I made rather a mess of it because we lost a lot of blankets. And we practiced blowing up pumping stations and locks in Leith and Rosyth and Edinburgh, based at Burnt Island. Then I was sent down to Cardiff where to prepare for our reception by the Welsh Regiment. And we went into barracks. This wasn't the whole lot. There was another detachment doing the same thing in Southampton. We were with Bill Pritchard, and we went down there, and he sent me on to prepare with the Welsh Regiment. And we all went down there. The officers lived in the Angel Hotel, or Diggs, and the troops were in the Welsh Regiment depot. And we practiced blowing up Pontypool and Newport and Cardiff. We learned how to lure sacks of explosive against the lock gates, the points where it would do the most damage. And we learned how to deal with these big metal cassoons, empty, narrow chambers which slot into the locks to close the locks. And also the pumping machinery, the impeller pumps, and the machinery required to empty a lock and to transfer water in the lock system. And we did that for